All right, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to SaberSims DFS Office Hours. It is Monday, May 23rd of 2022. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the stream here today. If this is your first time watching or listening to Office Hours, my name's Jordan. I'm the head coach here at SaberSim. And on this show, it's an open Q&A style show where I answer questions from the SaberSim community about SaberSim, about DFS strategy, whatever you guys want to talk about. Your questions drive the conversations that we have here on this particular stream. If you have questions for me, you can email us, support@sabersim.com. You can type your questions live into YouTube chat, or you can ask your questions in the Office Hours channel in Slack. And if you are somehow not yet in our awesome Slack community, there's a link to join in the description of every past stream on YouTube and on all of the podcast versions of this stream. So should be an interesting one here for us today. We've got some good questions already in front of us. Some pretty kind of broader questions about, the steps it takes to build the best lineups we can to be as successful as possible playing DFS. I think particularly a baseball DFS angle on that one. I see a question here about reviewing past slates, which we'll talk a little bit. Question about hockey correlation. All kinds of different questions here. I see some more coming in Office Hours now. So we'll go ahead and let's dive in here and get started. We'll just get going here. So let me pull up this first question. This came in from Justin over email. And we will start here. So Justin said, I play 5 to 10 entries per MLB slate, typically $2 to $7 per entry. What types of settings have generated the best results in your experience? Any specific stack rules or ownership percentages I should be focusing on? Haven't used the rules in SaberSim just yet. I usually don't go over any over 60% on any players per slate. What's the most proven recipe for taking down big tournaments? Now, I'll talk a little bit about this. I'll talk a little bit about some strategies that I think you can use to be successful on SaberSim. I do want to kind of preface this by saying, you know, there isn't really the just that one kind of thing that you can do and just start taking down massive GPPs every night, right? What our goal really when we're playing some of these larger field tournaments to do is to increase our chance of winning greater than what the average fair share chance of a lineup taking down a tournament would be, right? So if you're playing a 10,000 person tournament, right? You've got a 1 in 10,000 shot on average to win that. And that's not even accounting for a rake, right? Just raw probabilities, 1 in 10,000 if everybody was perfectly average, right? Our goal there is to increase that, you know, maybe to something like 1 in 5,000, right? 2x the field or 1 in, 3,333. You're three times better than average expectation. But these raw probabilities of winning something like this, a big GPP like this, is still relatively low. And that's why the most important thing when it comes to being successful in DFS is bankroll management and contest selection to make sure you can weather the swings of the variance, giving yourself time to take something down. So I do want to just address this, you know, the proven recipe to taking down big tournaments. There isn't one. There are steps you can take. I think SaberSim gets you further along the process of building good GPP lineups than anything else out there. From there, where each individual person is going to add their value to maybe push that a little bit further is going to be different. But there is no proven recipe to taking down big tournaments. And I think that is worth saying. And I think that's a point worth making. Now, kind of coming back a little bit more here to the practical side, what types of settings have generated the best results in your experience? So on settings, it doesn't even actually have to be a matter of my personal experience. We have back-tested our default settings here with more simulations and more data than you could even realistically play in a 10-year sample size of DFS. So I do feel very confident that the default sliders for the contest that you're playing are the best settings to use for your particular contests, right? So I know you had mentioned you're playing 5 to 10 entries per baseball slate. I don't know, that probably a mix of single entry to three max kind of stuff, I imagine, is where that's mostly coming from. Using the settings that have been back tested for those particular contests are going to be the best way to go. Above all else, right? Because the way these are actually generated is we've built lineups at every single different combination of different sliders and compared them to past contests of these different sizes and types and things like that. And this is actually these sliders where the highest value lineups were produced for that particular contest. So in terms of settings, I'd stick pretty close to there. But let's build some lineups here. Again, I'm going to assume that you're kind of mostly in the single entry and three max streets there with these based on your message here. And we'll talk a little bit about this. A few other things that I kind of like to look for here or ways that I think you can add a little bit of value here to your overall process. So let's let this build for a second here and we'll talk about this. Grab a sip of water here real quick. You guys will notice I got the black background up here behind me today. Might be a little bit more of a frequent part of the stream, at least for a bit here. We're starting to pack up and move a new permanent home for my life, but also for the DFS office hours stream. So as the house becomes increasingly in disarray here, got to put up the background. Yeah, so Rogue spotted it here. Yeah, new background. Got the pop-up up today here. So cool. Okay, so we've got the build screen up. A couple things here. So first of all, I have no issue. I will not talk anybody out of capping maximum exposure. So you mentioned you're capping your max exposure to 60% here. No problem with that, right? That's mostly a risk tolerance thing here of saying, you know, I don't want, if I'm going to play 10 lineups at this particular bankroll investment, I don't want more than, 60% of any one particular player to be in my lineups, right? That makes sense. That's mostly a personal risk tolerance thing. I'm good with that. A couple things that I think can be kind of valuable here overall when you're trying to figure out, you know, what's the next step. I always like to look at my stacks because we're pulling in the correlation data directly from the sims. You won't need to set as many stack rules on SaberSim as you might be used to on other tools out there. But I still like to do a little bit of a review of my stack types. And on a big 10 game slate like we have here today, I probably really want to maximize my correlation, really play mostly a lot of bigger stacks, try to capitalize on an outcome where there is a team that has a big ceiling outcome. So I always like to come in here, take a look at my stacks. I don't think a 3-3-2 stack is all too bad, right? That's still a pretty correlated stack, but I often want to be getting to those big 4-3s, 4-4s, 5-3s, 5-2s kind of stacks for a larger slate. On a smaller slate, anything less than like 6 games or something like that, 5 or 6 games, I'll get a little bit more flexible with my stack types, but I always like to do a little bit of research into those stack types, make sure they're stacked up the way I want, right? Then the other thing I do here, and I might do this differently if I was just playing 10 lineups. I typically like to kind of get an idea of what does the chalk look like and what are my stances on the chalk here, right? So I'll sort by ownership and get an idea. I'll do this typically split up pitchers and hitters. And I just want to make sure, you know, even in a smaller field, single entry kind of thing, I don't really want to be playing all of the chalk, right? And again, we're going to be taking into account ownership fade accordingly when you go to build your lineups. But I like to do a little bit of additional research here and make sure that I'm not completely leveraged against I'm not completely just eating chalk here. And, you know, this is a really interesting slate we have in front of us here tonight, because I think we're going to have this insanely chalky combination of two pitchers here. It's a kind of a bad pitching slate apart from Cole up top, and then we have this like severely underpriced Marco Gonzalez. So I feel like this combination is going to be super popular. And if we saw here just a second ago before I adjusted exposure, SaberSim actually wanted to play 100% exposure. Maybe not. Never mind. I thought when we first pulled this build up, it looked like actually, yeah. Let's go back here. Yeah, so before we, SaberSim wanted to play 100% exposure to each of these pitchers here before we made any adjustments to that, right? So what I might do here is, I guess to put this in more useful terms, that isn't just how do I do this for this particular slate? How do I do this in general? I kind of want to make sure that I'm taking some stands somewhere. So if I'm going to eat a lot of pitching chalk, I might come over here and look at the highest projected owned batters and maybe fade some of these chalkier batters, right? Or at least be under. It looks like we think, you know, Dodgers, KC, Minnesota are going to be the popular stacks. I might experiment with, you know, maybe even taking a really aggressive stand on some of these chalkier bats, fading these guys, and seeing how the lineups look coming out of this, right? And now we're getting a little bit more of a balanced approach to ownership. Still got a little bit of exposure to Turner and Buxton here, but just making sure that we're not just eating all of the chalk on both the hitting side and the pitching side from there. So, you know, that's a lot of times my approach for baseball this season. That's kind of pretty similar of what it looks like, right? I'm running the builds. I'm using default settings. I'll do some other, you know, kind of test builds throughout the day and see how things are looking. I think, you know, another thing that you can do is I like to use this Fantasy Labs dashboard as a way to kind of get a second opinion on what the best hitting spots are and what the perceived best hitting spots are on a slate. So for example, you know, if I'm trying to figure out, okay, so I want to fade the chalk, right? And SaberSim says the chalk is going to be KC and the Dodgers. Well, I might go over here and look at the implied live totals. And yeah, I think the Dodgers are going to be pretty chalky, but maybe based on this second opinion, the Royals aren't as chalky here. Here, let me, let's go change this view, right? So, you know, Vegas doesn't think that the Royals are one of the better hitting spots on the slate. Maybe they're a little underpriced, but maybe they're not going to be as chalky as we think. So I might be actually willing, when I come back over here, you know, I might reset this and end up being willing to play some KC bats, but just fade the Dodgers bats. So, and that would feel pretty good. But again, kind of in summary here, what I'm doing, right? Default settings. In terms of what setting should I use, I'd recommend sticking pretty close to the default settings here. And then when you build your lineups, manage your risk appropriately. If you don't want more than 60% of any one player, I think that's totally fine. It makes a lot of sense. I do a little bit of player exposure editing like that as well. And then I want to just kind of, you know, provide the final decision, I guess, the final say over my correlation and my ownership. What stances am I taking against ownership? What stances am I taking to correlate my lineups here? I typically want to make sure on a bigger slate that I'm getting nice big stacks, and I want to make sure that I'm taking some ownership stances somewhere. So, and I think that's kind of a good, again, there are a lot of different ways to add additional value to SaberSim. Everybody's process is going to be a little bit different, but I think that's a really good starting point on how to do that for baseball. So, Glenn said, I hear KC is chalky today from elsewhere. Yeah, and our ownership projections have been pretty dialed in this season. So if we say they're going to be chalky, I feel pretty confident that they are. I just do think that second opinion can sometimes be pretty useful. It seems like a pricing thing to me. They must be, yeah, so they're pretty cheap. Like, really cheap, actually. And who's pitching for Arizona? Zach Davies, not the best pitcher either. So yeah, it makes sense that they might be a little bit chalkier, especially, you know, if a lot of the field is going to get, expensive Dodgers and Yankees, and Garrett Cole, a pitcher, it makes a lot of sense. So I could see it there, but yeah. And DG makes a good point here. And actually this was something else I had kind of wanted to reiterate. So, said I'm behind on the stream, but can you repeat that more often? The most crucial way to be successful in DFS is bankroll management and contest selection. Crucial. Yeah. And that's a really good point. And I think I went over that pretty fast, right? I wanted to point out, you know, I think the best thing, if you want one piece of advice that I can give for your baseball DFS season, as we're, you know, hitting into the main part, not really into the main part of the summer yet, but approaching kind of the heat of baseball season here, is making sure that your bankroll selection and contest selection is dialed in. And I recorded a video, it's up on our YouTube channel, on this MLB DFS in 2022 playlist. Pretty short, 20-minute video walking through bankroll management and contest selection principles to be successful playing this season. And I think the best advice I could give anybody that was saying, you know, give me one thing I can do to improve my baseball results this year, I would make sure that you're playing with a strong bankroll management and contest selection fundamentals. Because, you know, in baseball, you can really, the ranges of outcomes for players are so wide that you can play optimally or very close to optimally, or play in a way that's positive EV for a night or a week or even a month and do really poorly. Just because, you know, you can, it's very easy for things to not go your way in baseball. In basketball, all the players are so normally distributed and their outcomes, their most common outcomes are centered around their mean, that it's hard to just get crushed on a given basketball slate if you play the best plays, right? Or just play even positive EV. In baseball, it's pretty easy to get crushed. So you need to come at it from that standpoint of giving yourself enough time to weather the swings of variance there. So, but Rogue said, can you explain the term chalk? Yeah, so chalk, when people say somebody's chalky, they just mean they're going to be popular. They're going to be highly owned is all somebody's saying. That's all I'm saying. So if I say, you know, I think I said Garrett Cole and Marco Gonzalez combination is going to be chalky tonight. That means I think a lot of lineups are going to roster both of those two pitchers. So it actually comes back from old school horse racing, where odds makers would have the current odds for horses up written on a chalkboard. And the horses that were getting bet on most heavily, the odds, the lines would have to shift most often. So they'd be erasing the chalk, right? They'd be erasing the chalk writing of the whatever the current line was on that horse and writing the new one based after all these bets were coming in. That's where chalky actually comes from. So, but yeah, it basically just means a player that is going to be popular or a stack or whatever. So. Okay, cool. I see a bunch of questions in YouTube chat here. I want to first quickly hit a few questions that I noticed in Slack, and then we'll get to everything here. Okay, this is an interesting one. This was from D34, and he said, with the 8-6 Calgary win and similar, there's an idea that opposite side skaters could be positively correlated in that they both score more if the game turns into a shootout. I noticed Hackey, pretty skilled NHL DFS player, for those of you that are not familiar with Hackey, has been stacking 7 to 8 skaters from the same game lately, but the builder doesn't see a correlation between Toffoli and McDavid. Can you talk about whether noticing games like that is an observation bias versus the builder having blind spots to certain outcomes? Yeah, it's a good question. It's tricky, right? Let's go take a look at this here. I am curious just kind of what these correlations look like in general. So I do think, let's see. Let's look at just the Avs and Blues game here. So I'm just kind of seeing if we see any. So there is a very light correlation between a guy like McKinnon and some of the other skaters, but it looks like mostly defensemen on the Blues. I'll say this. So I think something like that intuitively makes sense. And it's definitely possible that we have a little bit of a blind spot there, or maybe there's just a better, you know, maybe there's a strategy that, you know, is profitable or successful that isn't just getting picked up within the correlation data. It's difficult to know with these kinds of things if there's actually something there or if it is just an observation bias from just a single game sample or something like that. So I will openly state that I am not a big hockey DFS player. I don't know it as well as other sports. I don't know. I think it intuitively does make some sense. Willie K says this is not a real thing. So maybe a stronger stance there. I think it does make some intuitive sense that, you know, a team that is way down needs to score more, right? But I don't know if you get that shootout kind of correlation that you get in like something like football as much here on the ice. I think if you're noticing a trend from a sharp NHL DFS player out there, I think it makes some sense to take some shots on it, to try some game stacks. I don't know if I'm a little on the fence if I'm totally bought in here on the theory overall. I will say, you know, two things. So first of all, at the moment, our correlations look at the full range of outcomes across every game, right? So we're saying on average, you know, whether a player is scoring highly or low, right? This is their average correlation. This is, you know, if you plotted out all of the different ranges of outcomes for two different players, how similar are they? Is essentially what our correlation measures at the moment. We're actually working on an improvement to that correlation model that I would expect for us to, you know, have ready in the next coming weeks, few weeks, I guess, to focus a little bit more on essentially an upside correlation that instead correlates more for, you know, looks at how correlated are players when one player is having their upside condition, right? We don't really care about, you know, how correlated are the Blues skaters to the Avalanche skaters if this game ends up being final score of 1-2 or something like that, or 1-0, right? We want to say how correlated are these players when we get that extreme outcome on the upside end. So we're actually going to be making some improvements to our correlation model to account for that. Pretty excited about that change here. And I would be interested to see once that is done, if if game stacks end up showing up as a little bit more of a viable option here to capitalize on that, especially in really large field stuff where you need to just maximize that 99th percentile, 95th percentile outcome. In the meantime, I think Willie K makes a good point. There's four teams to choose from at this point. You're naturally going to get game stacks when you're running out a bunch of lineups. Yeah, I think that's true. That's probably going to happen automatically. If you want to take a shot on game stacking up a little bit more than that, I think that's another option as well. So, but again, not my area of expertise, to be completely honest. I know that when I had last year, I had Mr. Clean and Couch on from the SaberSim community, who are a little bit more skilled NHL DFS players than I am. And I remember talking about this with them, and neither of those guys said that they were doing a ton of NHL game stacking, focusing more on the strong correlations for given lines. But I don't hate it in a good environment, especially on playoff hockey where we only have these two games to choose from. So, but Willie K makes another good point here. Line matching is important. If line one versus St. Louis is constantly out there versus Edmonton line one, you're going to have negative correlation more times than not. Only one team can control puck possession wall on ice, and you can only score DFS points when you have the puck. Yeah, that's a fair point as well. That is a good point. Cool. Iteru in Slack said upside correlation. Yes, please. Yeah, it will have that effect. I think people get a very particular idea in mind when I say upside correlation. And I think we're actually going to do things a little bit different. But yeah, it will have that practical effect. So. I wanted to touch on a couple other questions here that had come in over the weekend. Let's hit this one here. So this was from Toasted Taters. He said, I'm trying to do a research build for showdown slates and uploading max exposures. I seem to be having trouble getting those max exposures to enter into the build. Does this have to do with the same players having multiple player IDs for Util, MVP, Pro, Star, etc.? Yes. So this is the FanDuel thing. At the moment, your minimum and maximum exposures will apply globally and not on individual multiplier positions. If you want to get very dialed in on your exposures for the multiplier positions for single game FanDuel NBA DFS, what I would recommend doing instead, build with a very high sim precision, probably 10, give yourself a big pool of 1500 lineups and make your adjustments on the build screen and dial in your exposures from there. I know it's a little bit tedious, but uploading them because they're all matched to the same player ID won't work the way that you might hope it would at the moment. So yes, we'll kind of show you what I mean here on this build screen. But so if you want to, if you want 30% Jimmy Butler at MVP and 25% at the star, and I don't know, whatever you want, 20% at the pro position or something like that, right? With a very high sim precision and pool of 1500 lineups, I would say you probably can get your exposures about exactly where you want them. You shouldn't have any issues with that. So, okay. And then good question from JTR here. He said, is there a way to download my pool of lineups so that the file includes all of the ranking info, rank, salary, projected score, Saber score? Not at the moment, unfortunately. But this is also something that is on our very soon roadmap. We've been talking about this. This is something that I would expect in one of our next updates to be added. So I know there's a lot of people out there, myself included, that do different things where you're downloading your entire pool of 1500 lineups for, to select those lineups separately yourself, to do research, whatever you prefer. And at the moment, it's just a lineup file, but we want to add the ability to export your you know, Sabre score, those lineups, projected ownership, that kind of thing, salaries, et cetera, without having to recalculate that for yourself. So no at the moment, but soon the answer to this question is yes. So, and I will personally be pretty excited for that one as well. Question from BZ here. Is doing the daily missions on DK worth it if it's over your bankroll allotment? Probably not. I imagine that you are getting pennies on the dollar for the crowns for those daily missions. So I would say it's probably not worth breaking your bankroll management and contest selection principles to chase those. If you can play them, and it fits into what you're doing otherwise, or, you know, if you're torn between two contests and there's a nice tiebreaker that one of them completes a mission for you and you can bag some crowns, it's worth it. But probably not worth it to just chase those for whatever the crown bonuses are. I will show you guys, you know, keep in mind on DraftKings, every once in a while to go and check your achievements. So if you go to rewards, see, I already have some in here that I haven't picked up recently. So I went in and cleared these all out a couple days ago, and I had like 40,000 crowns that I hadn't collected. But go in, check your achievements every once in a while and make sure you're claiming these. There's a lot, you know, once you start to ramp up a lot of crowns, there's a lot you can do with them. You can enter contests. If you have access to the sports book, you can just cash it out straight up into DK dollars, which is pretty nice. You can buy things in the weird store thing. I haven't done any of that yet, but basically the point I'm making, don't forget to go cash these out every once in a while, because they won't do it for you. So, but I did this on Friday, I think, and I got another 2,000 crowns here from the weekend. So, but on the actual question here, so the missions, right? I check on these every once in a while. So I don't know. I don't think I'm entered in any $5 contest for 125 crowns. Maybe it'd be worth it for me. Maybe it wouldn't, but I wouldn't like break the bank to go chase crowns. So, Guy Will Gamble said, for someone struggling with MLB, are there any helpful pointers or process-oriented tips you can provide? Okay, so these are always tough questions. There's a lot of different ways to go. So first of all, I know Guy Will Gamble, you watch a lot of these, so I'm sure you're pretty familiar with what I'm going to say first here. But for anybody else, I really do, you know, make sure that you are playing in a way, playing with strong bankroll management and contest selection principles, right? Start with this video. If you are not playing, you can like legitimately double your ROI or take a process that is slightly losing to break even or slightly profitable purely by just shifting and playing softer contests. So I definitely recommend watching this video and make sure you're playing the best contest possible. We'll also be doing some more contest selection content here in the new future. We've been doing some analysis on our end to kind of back test some of our contest selection principles here. So that should be coming out in the next couple weeks as well. And really make sure that you are playing in a bankroll process that's sustainable, because you are going to have less. It is probably true in baseball in particular that lineups that truly have top 1% equity have a lot less min cash equity than in a sport like NBA. So what that ultimately means is that as you are waiting to realize the edge that you have in baseball, you are going to go through worse swings, because the lineups that are failing to get to that top 1% that night are not 2Xing or 3Xing on the min cash line. They're losing straight up, even though they're profitable, they're positive EV lineups. Whereas, you know, we just got out of NBA season where I think you can kind of, you'll have a lot. If you have a lot of top 1% equity, it's probably also true that you have, you know, top 20% equity. My like finishing percentile graph for baseball looks a lot different than basketball, where I have almost this barbell outcome where I have a lot of outcomes where I'm in the top 1%. I have a lot of outcomes where I'm finishing at the bottom. Whereas in basketball, it's a much more flatter, and maybe I'll pull up these graphs on stream at some point, so you guys can see it. But anyway, the swings are a lot more high variance in baseball, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're doing anything wrong. I had gone back and forth on this in particular at the start of the season, but I am kind of coming back to the idea here that one way to smooth out that variance can be spreading out your action into different slates and things like showdowns and the smaller slates throughout the day. So if you're playing, you know, 5% of your bankroll every night in the main slate, instead spreading that out and getting some action down in some of maybe the showdowns or the smaller slates, I think can be a decent way to smooth that out a little bit as well. I've had slates this year where the main slate went terribly, and because I was really successful on a random turbo or a night slate, I ended up coming out of that with a profitable night. I think that can be really helpful as well. In terms of kind of process, I have had my most success really diving deep into my research build strategy. And really trying to see, you know, where can I find the biggest inefficiencies in the market for that particular slate. So I haven't even done this yet today. But doing these and taking pretty significant stands off of them, right? So my goal with these research builds here is to basically determine what's the percent chance a player ends up in the optimal. And using these and trying to find a few particular spots to take a stand against ownership, I found has been the path to success for most of my slates where I've been profitable this season, right? And what I've noticed too in baseball in particular is that it hasn't really been so much about leveraging against every ownership inefficiency on the slate. I've really been focusing on finding like where are the biggest mistakes that the field is going to make, right? There's typically, you know, maybe one or two pitchers that I feel like the field is really just not thinking about the right way, really overowning, or a stack, one or two stacks that's just very over the top. And I've just been taking a really significant stance on those guys. So let's look at this here and see, right? And I guess the other thing too on these research builds is combining it with like an understanding of the actual probabilities of events, of these events happening. Like, let me give you an example. So Gerrit Cole, right? You might look at this and immediately say, well, negative 14.3% leverage, right? And say, that's inefficient. I'm going to fade him, right? But he is the most likely, he's like even odds to be an optimal pitcher on the slate, right? 50% chance to be optimal. Twice as much as the next best projected pitcher, who's the very chalky Marco Gonzalez, who's still just a little bit negative leverage, right? And then from there, it's like a dumpster fire of pitchers for the remaining guys. So on this particular slate, I might not be looking to fade pitchers, and I might just kind of eat some of that chalk. Let's look at the batters, though. On the batting side, we have quite a bit of inefficiency here on the KC and Dodgers bats, right? Especially KC. A team that's looking like they're going to be really chalky because they're really cheap. And, you know, 15% Carlos Santana that shows up in the optimal 3.3% of the time, right? I might be looking at taking a really aggressive stance on Dodgers and KC bats, right? And just figuring out where that chalk is going to be and fading it gives you a ton of leverage when you're on the right side of that, right? And it's so easy to be on the right side of that. We're talking about, you know, fading a 20% owned guy that's only going to be in the optimal 10% of the time, right? Talking about fading maybe a 30%, 25% owned Dodger stack that's only going to be optimal 12.5% of the time. It just makes it very easy to do that there. And the last note, and this is, I guess, kind of shifting back to the other direction of thinking about kind of more of that risk management side of things. One way, if you are swinging really hard if you're finding that the swings of variance are pretty intense on your bankroll for baseball, cap your exposures, right? Lower your exposure to different players. So even if you're playing 20 lineups, right? The more equity that you can give yourself in min cash positions, or not even min cash. I don't want to say that because I feel like I'm going to give the wrong impression. The more equity that you can have in a contest of getting paid out at all lowers the... It raises the number of slates that you need to play. Wait, let me think about the right way to say this. The more money that you can win back on a given slate basically lets you play more slates with the same bankroll and gives you a longer runway to realize your edge, right? If you're winning back 75% of your entries every night, which isn't really realistic, right? You need to win far less often than somebody that's winning back 0% of their entry fees every night, even if you guys have the same ROI long-term. So I think one way that you can give yourself a little bit more time to realize the edge of leveraging against ownership, correlating your lineups in baseball, right? The better. So that might just look like doing something as basic as setting a max exposure of 60%, like Justin was talking about here at the start of the stream, right? And even though this may not increase your expected value or your theoretical ROI, it's going to make it a much more pleasant process getting to there in the long term. So I kind of bounced all over the place there a little bit. I hope that was helpful. I think kind of to sum up here, first of all, strong bankroll management and contest selection principles. If you don't know what those are, watch this video on our YouTube channel. Two, I think spreading out your risk and giving yourself more opportunities to realize your edge in the form of spreading out exposures to players on a particular slate and spreading out and playing more slates with the same amount of bankroll, I think can be a really good way to make the swings a little less painful. And on the actual finding your edge component of baseball DFS, I think the best things you can do are making sure that your lineups are as correlated as possible, right? SaberSim automates a lot of that for you, but spending a little bit of time studying your stacks and making sure that your stack types are appropriate here. And then finding, I think finding a specific ownership inefficiency edge to push that makes sense for that particular slate, is very effective for baseball because the ranges of outcomes for players are so wide that chalk is typically bad, right? I think interesting slate again here tonight with the pitching where I actually am, I'm pretty in on these two chalky pitchers, but just so easy to fade these super high owned value stacks like KC, and even the Dodgers a little bit here on a slate like tonight when their odds of being that best stack are actually just so low. So, but yeah, good question. Tough one, but a fun one. All right. This one's from TRD. You're going to be TRD from now on here. You know who I'm talking to, or you know who you are if I'm talking to you. I think it's possible that saying this name out loud got the video from last week pulled down at least temporarily, but I could be wrong. The question is, how much variance is there in the correlation data from day to day? I imagine it would stay somewhat static within a specific sport, but have you noticed any big jumps or shifts ever? If so, do you have any idea why this might have happened? Really good question. I would say in baseball, I wouldn't ever expect significant correlation shifts above and beyond the batting order correlation here, right? So like players are going to be a little bit, hitters are going to be slightly more correlated to the hitters in the order that are close to them in the order, right? Anytime anybody in the batting order gets on base, it stalls an out. It makes the game longer. So, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing. But there is still that, you know, same play scoring correlation where, you know, leadoff hitter gets on base and the two hole hitter gets a two run home run, right? And they both score. So they're a little extra correlated there. So you would have some minor shifts there from day to day for baseball and correlation on that department. Above and beyond that, I don't think there would be something that would otherwise significantly shift correlations in a sport like football or something like that. You know, correlations could shift on a week-to-week basis if there was an injury, first of all, but also just a change in the way that the team played, right? If you have a situation where the guy that was the fourth wide receiver has become the de facto second option for the quarterback, that's going to increase his correlation to the quarterback quite a bit. I think that's it. I think those are the kind of the main things that come to mind. I guess the big ones would be something changing with the team in the form of an injury or otherwise the team changing. But I otherwise wouldn't expect much day-to-day variance, especially in a sport like baseball. The guys that are in the lineup together are going to have probably pretty similar correlations to one another. So, but let me know if you, this is one of those questions. So I'm also just giving you a hard time, man. I see your chat in Slack. Don't worry about it. It is all good. But let me know if there was a reason you're asking that question too. So here it is. So let's read this. Cause this, sometimes I get questions here where I read the question and I answer it and I can just tell that there's something behind the scenes that you're scheming up. Was in hockey mode when thinking about that too, when lines change, et cetera, fully correlated top lines that are also fully correlated on the top power player super important for me. Yeah, so that came up last week, and the sims do kind of pick up on that automatically, right? So the biggest correlations that you're going to see here are going to be the guys that share the same even strength and power play line. And then, you know, from there, kind of a spectrum of guys that share the ice together at different times, given, you know, whether the team's on a power play or not, right? But you can see this discrepancy here. I know this is kind of hard to see, right? When we look at a guy like McKinnon's correlations, right? Most heavily correlated to the other skaters that he's on the ice the most with. So that kind of thing does get taken into account. If you do want to dial that in even a little bit further, you can always set a stacking rule. I think, honestly, at this point in the season, two-game hockey slates, you're going to need to get so close to the optimal to take something down. I don't know how much I would be leaning on hockey on stacks, like specific types of stacks for hockey. But we do have the ability to set stacking rules to force different combinations of same line skaters. And during the regular season, especially for big slates, 10-game, 12-game hockey slate, I like doing that kind of stuff. Just to give the raw correlation data a little bit of an additional nudge. So, all right, let's see. Okay. A couple other questions here. I know YouTube chat is waiting very patiently here for me. I'm going to hit these couple other questions that came in through Slack over the weekend. This is a quick one. This was from Drew. Brett, best sliders for a three-man league. Best sliders for anything are always going to be the defaults. So come in here. If you're playing a three-man league, sounds like a three-man triple up, I guess, is essentially what that would be, right? We'll call it a GPP. Single entry, less than 10. I would approach it like this. And I think all the sliders are going to be about the same at that point. Oh, no. Okay. Yeah, I would do something like this. Wait, why is this? Feels like this is bouncing around a little on me. Hold on. Let me get a refresh here. I think I broke something. Okay. GPP, single entry, less than 10. There we go. That's what I would use. So basically all questions about the sliders in general is always going to be just let SaberSim do the hard work for you on setting the build settings. You tell us what contest you're playing for. So, okay. Let's see. I think we're all caught up there. Let's hop over to YouTube chat. Question from Jen. Hello, can you please go over how to review an MLB DFS session at the end of each day? Specifically, how can we tell if a certain fading or chalking decision was reasonable? Thanks. That's tough. That's a hard question to answer, right? Because you're ultimately just going to be dealing with a single game sample size, right? You may say, you know what, forget it. I'm not playing a 60% owned Garrett Cole tonight, and maybe I'm playing some Orioles stacks. No matter what happens, right? Even if you're right, even if the Orioles go off, right? Which I do think is a little bit of an interesting angle just because, you know, it's in Yankee Stadium. Cole's kind of a fly ball pitcher. It's like, I feel like there's a path to success for Orioles stacks there, especially a guy 60% owned maybe. But that aside, right? No matter what happens in that game, it's one data point. How do you know if that actually was the right decision, right? I think there are a couple different ways to, I think there are a couple different ways to do this. So first of all, part of the reason that I like to run my research builds, right? So these builds that I run, 1500 lineups, 0-0-10 sliders. I'm looking at single slate simulation optimals. Part of the reason I like this strategy is because it gives you that extra data, those extra data points to make better decisions, right? So, you know, I might look at this and say, okay, no, I'm actually going to play Garrett Cole because it looks like he's optimal 50% of the time. And it looks like he's actually pretty efficiently owned, right? So I'm just going to play him. And even if he does still get lit up, at least I can say, well, the data of simulations, 1500 of them told me that this is a pretty good idea. And I might fade I might fade KC stacks because I'll say, you know, I think they're going to be 25% owned, 20% owned, whatever. And they're only going to be optimal 10% of the time. And if they're optimal and they go off, then so be it. At least I can come at that and say, process-wise, that was still a good decision. That's one way. I think another way of thinking about this here instead is to ask yourself if there are assumptions of, if there are assumptions coming up in your research that are guiding you to those decisions. So one might be, for example, you know, maybe you're looking at pitchers here and you want to be on the other side of Marco Gonzalez, right? Maybe you want to fade Marco Gonzalez. And the reason why is because this pitch count looks high, right? Maybe you don't think he's going to get as many pitches as we're projecting, 108, 102 pitches, right? Now, even if he goes out, let's say he goes out strikeout prone A's team and throws, you know, I don't know, five innings, gets pulled relatively early, but happens to kind of strike out eight, right? Well, I think you could come at that and say, you know, maybe my decision to fade was still a good idea because he isn't pitching as much as we projected or something like that, right? Or let's take this the other way. Let's say you decide that you want to fade Marco Gonzalez because you don't think his ownership is going to be 30%. You think it's going to be 45%. Well, again, if he goes out and crushes the slate, right, strikes out eight or something like that and is one of the optimal pitchers, if that ownership projection was still right, if he was 45% owned, you might have still been on the right side of that decision, even if you were wrong. So I think you can try to separate out the actual results of the fantasy points that are scored and look at the assumptions that are going into your decisions, right? A really classic one that I used to use for NBA was minutes. So if you had a team that had a couple injuries, right? You've got a rotation of guys that maybe haven't played together that much that season. And maybe you've got some chalky value play that everybody's going to go on, right? I think fading that player because you think the minutes are going to go somewhere else is a way that's very easy to verify if you were right, regardless of what the fantasy point outcomes are in that game. If that chalky guy ends up only playing 20 minutes and there was some low-owned guy that got 30 minutes, even if the chalk guy goes out and hits six threes and ends up optimal, people that played him basically just got lucky. And that might've been a good decision. So looking into the actual, what is the assumption of what you're taking with you into your decision-making and checking at the end of the game, was that right? Right? Not how many fantasy points did this guy score, but was that right? And baseball is hard because I think there's a ton of different stats that you can look into if you want to go that direction. And it's a kind of a strange game. And I think it's a little bit harder to do this on any given night for one single game sample, but I think there's still a little bit of value there. The third one and the last one here that I'll mention is I think you can spend a little bit of time researching what other sharp players did. So I've talked about this on stream before. RotoGrinders has a free tool called ResultsDB. It's a partnership with Fantasy Labs. And you can go in here and see the exposures and lineups for different players in past contests. So let's go ahead and look at yesterday's main slate, which I didn't play. But if you wanted to, I think one important thing here is pick a contest that either is the contest you played or resembles it, right? If you go in here and you're trying to figure out what was the optimal strategy for a large field GPP by studying the chin music, you're going to have a bad time, right? But we can take the big GPP, for example, and look, you know, Giant Squid's always a good one, right? And again, I wouldn't even focus on who did the best on that particular slate, but maybe take a few different sharp, different players that you respect and see what they did in certain situations, right? And again, I have no context because I didn't play this slate, but if you're looking to see, you know, what pitching exposure did, so it looks like it was chalk Freddy Peralta night, probably something like that. Giant Squid faded, right? And I have no context for the slate again, but I think that can be a helpful data point for you if you were like, you know, I faded and got crushed. Was this the right decision? Yes. Anyway, to sum up, I think you can take advantage of the data of the sims themselves by running research builds to give yourself a bigger sample size than the one game that's going to play out tonight. And it can be reassuring if you have that kind of data to back up your decisions. Second is to separate out the actual fantasy point outcomes and figure out if there's an assumption baked into why you want to take a stance one way or the other, and then figure out something that is a little bit more solid than just the fantasy point output to back that up after, right? If you're fading a guy because you think he's going to be chalky, that's a good one, right? Was he chalky regardless of what the output is? If you're fading a pitcher because you think his velocity, like he's playing through an injury, his velocity's down, he's on a pitch count, something like that. Did that actually happen, that kind of thing. So Jen said, thanks. To give you some context, I went for 30 to 35% for Baltimore on Saturday after looking hard at the Vegas numbers. They only scored one run that night, but I wanted to know if my decision was still sound. What happened Saturday night? I didn't get to play a lot of DFS this weekend. I actually don't think I didn't play the night slate either, but let's take a quick look at it here. But I honestly have been in favor of these Baltimore stacks pretty frequently. I think they are at least intriguing tonight here, right? But here, let me tell you, maybe I can, let me see if I would have gotten any Baltimore stacks. I'm curious. Not that this is like the arbitration of objective truth here, but I'm going to run a research build for this past Saturday slate here and see if I would have gotten any exposure there. I bet I would have, because people never like to play Baltimore. They've got to be the most interesting stack on the slate here tonight too, right? Against 50, 60% owned Garrett Cole. I mean, I don't know. I think it's hard to not play any Baltimore tonight. In like 150, maybe 20 lineups even. Just the leverage you get there in a really hitter friendly ballpark, against a fly ball pitcher, even just taking a shot on like a couple two stacks or Baltimore one offs. The problem is I just don't know who you play at pitcher then. If you do that, because then I guess you're playing like Wheeler and Gonzalez, but if you're directly leveraging against Cole, right? I don't know who you play there. This build's kind of stalling out. I think I've kind of made the point clear anyway. But I also would say on stacks in baseball in particular, you really can virtually play anybody you want. I would probably be more inclined to tell you that this decision was maybe not a good one if they were like the super chalk, right? If you told me that you went massively over the field on Coors, well, actually Coors is maybe not even Coors. I don't know. I think if you are fading some chalk and playing maybe a little bit of an off the beaten path team and getting some exposure to a lower owned stack, it's almost always, I think, going to be probably a pretty good decision just because of the way that baseball plays out. But anyway, let's let this one go. Let's keep talking. Let's get to some other questions here. Rogue said, in terms of winning, are you looking for a larger percent of lineups in the scoring minimum, or are you looking for one lineup to end up in the top three? I am looking to put my lineups in the top 1% of the contest in general. That's mentally how I think about it, right? So if it is a 1,000 lineup contest, right, I am basically looking to put lineups in the top 10 is essentially my goal. Now, in larger, very larger field contests, you might even have to think about that more as the top 0.1%, like in the mini-max. 50,000 person contest, finishing in the top 1% is the top 500, and you don't even get paid out that well for that. So you might want to think about that as a little bit more shooting for the top 50, right? But no, I am not optimizing my strategy for min cash equity or for finishing over the cash line. And a very simple way of why is because you are getting paid 2-to-1 for something that has generally about a 1 in 5 average shot of happening. It's terrible odds. All of the equity is in the top 1%, top 0.1% of a contest. So that's what I shoot for when I'm building my lineups. Dat Boy Steven said, is it good to look at run optimal lineups before building lineups? I think one of the best things that you can do for yourself, especially as you're just getting started with SaberSim, is to start your process of building lineups for that particular slate by just coming in here and building lineups for your contest that you're playing and just seeing what they look like. What are the players that you're getting exposure to? Right here. Let's actually just do it. So let's do it. So you're sitting down to build lineups for a 20 max, right? And match this to the contest you're playing. If it's a 150, do that. If it's a single entry, do that. But come in here, build some lineups. And I do this. This is how I start my process every single day. And hopefully this build plays nice here and I don't have to refresh. But it doesn't look like we're getting a playing nice build. So let's bounce back to the one we just had pulled up. Okay, so let's reset exposures. Okay, so coming in here and seeing, you know, what is my exposure to my most exposed teams? how am I navigating the chalkiest players on the slate, right? What exposure am I getting to the highest projected owned players on the slate? What are my highest and most positive and most negative leverage plays on the slate? And I think that will help ground you and set the stage for you to do whatever else your process includes, whether that is doing some research, whether that is running some different builds, whether that's setting stacking rules or curating a player pool or all kinds of different things that you might want to do. I highly recommend running this build first. And the reason why this works with SaberSim is because SaberSim gets upside, right? If you did this on a traditional optimizer, all you're going to do is see all the cash lineups. And then so what? Now I know what the cash lineup looks like tonight. How does that help me in GPPs, right? Because we are building these lineups right out of the box by looking at the full range of outcomes of players, by looking at their correlation, by looking at their ownership, these are actually viable GPP lineups immediately. So you can see this is an angle, this is a strategy to take on the slate. And you can almost just see it here, right? It's eat the pitching chalk, eat these elite two pitching plays, and get onto some less popular stacks in the form of Seattle, Houston, Arizona, right? Fade the KC and Dodger stacks. Now, that's not the only way to play the slate, but that's kind of the default. That's what you will get if you were setting lineups right now or something resembling that right now, ready to lock and load. So yeah, I think it's always a good start to help ground you and figure out what you want to do from there. So, okay. A-Lake said, when playing cash MLB, do you tend to stack on a 10-game slate or choose the best SaberSim lineup in cash? I would not force correlation, but I also would not, I would probably not actively avoid it. So let me show you what I mean. So I would build the cash lineups at 0-0-0 sliders, right? Which is going to be purely the best optimals based on the average projections. And then we can pull this up here. So sometimes you are going to get a slate where there is such an elite hitting spot that it makes sense to stack up a team at least a little bit, right? So let's quickly do this. So let's see if we have any of those. But like Coors slates are pretty good examples of that. So we actually, tonight's not really one of those slates, right? We have a couple two stacks, two twos, two two twos, a couple three twos that have snuck in there. But for the most part, we're pretty spread out on our hitters. There are certain slates where sometimes, you know, especially if Coors is on the slate, where it can, the cash optimal, the best optimal cash lineup you could play, will have three, four, probably rarely five, but three or four guys from the same team. If there's a team, you know, projected for a full run better than everybody else, I won't avoid it in those situations. If that's the way to play, then that's what I'll do. Disclaimer here is I haven't been playing baseball cash, at least not this season. I played it a lot more in the past. I prefer to get my money down in GPPs at this point. I think they're more profitable. But historically, I haven't intentionally avoided stacks or forced them. So yeah. Basically, the reason why we don't need to stack or want to stack in cash games is because we don't get paid more for an upside outcome, right? That's what correlation gives us in GPPs, right? Is we have, you know, if we're playing Freddie Freeman, well, what happens when Freddie Freeman does well, right? Other Dodgers bats got more opportunities to hit and probably got opportunities to score runs, get RBIs from when Freeman was on base, that kind of thing, right? And that continues to have this positive feedback loop that it makes it financially in our favor to play more and more Dodgers bats, because as that lineup scores more and more, we get paid more and more. In cash games, you just get paid the exact same for finishing above the cash line, right? So it doesn't, we don't get anything more about, you know, playing for a Dodger score 10 runs outcome, right? If Freddie Freeman is a good play at his price, then we can just play Freeman and we don't need to correlate there at all. So. .400 runner says, what's a good way to know when a player is overowned? I know you're supposed to fade overowned players, but is there an analytical way to evaluate this, or is it based all on intuition? That depends a lot on who you ask. I will show you what is essentially my fundamental strategy for knowing if a player is overowned. Basically, let me start by saying, you know, to me, the definition of overowned is a player whose likelihood of being in the winning lineup in that particular contest is lower than the ownership of that player in that particular contest. If a guy is going to be owned in 50% of lineups, but only has a 30% chance to be in the optimal lineup or in the winning lineup for that contest, that to me is a player that is overowned. So I have a strategy that I use on SaberSim to assess somewhat analytically. There are issues with some of the assumptions that of this process, but I have a strategy that I use to kind of assess whether or not I think a player is going to be over or under owned. I call it a research build. And essentially what I do here is I will build build lineups, and I turn correlation and ownership fade off. So first of all, you'll need to, if you're just pop this up, you'll need to turn manual mode on. And then I turn sim precision to 10. And then I build 1500 lineups. So what this does, at sim precision 10, we use a single game simulation and use the fantasy point output that those players scored in that single game simulation for every game on the slate. Every lineup is built as an optimal for a single slate simulation of how the slate could play out. I want to look purely at just optimals for this process. So I turn correlation off and I turn ownership off because I'm not interested in those factors here. All I want to do is what is the likelihood of a player showing up in the optimal lineup for a 1500 slate simulation, right? And then I will build this, and it'll take a minute to build. And then what I do here at the end of this, let me let this build first, and I won't get ahead of myself here. While this is building, I'll talk about some of the issues here, some of the assumptions that I'm making, right? Because this is not a perfect strategy. There are issues with this, right? One assumption that I'm making is that the probability of a player being in the optimal lineup is the same as the player's probability of being in the winning lineup in any given contest. That is not true. We do not need the actual optimals to win most of the time in GPPs. So that is just an assumption that I'm making here that isn't perfect, but I think it works out okay for what I'm trying to do. The second one is that ownership projections. Well, I guess the second really is that we're at the whims of the ownership projections and the sims themselves, right? I'm assuming that the ownership projections are exactly accurate for whatever contest I'm playing for, and that the sims are essentially perfect here as well, right? But with those assumptions in mind, I can compare how often is a player showing up in the optimal in 1500 lineups to the ownership projection and come up with players that I think are over or under owned, right? So, for example, right? Now, I don't think you can take this in a vacuum, but Gerrit Cole, according to this, appears to be 6% overowned if this number is right and this number is right, right? His optimal ownership would be about 51%. His actual ownership is 57%. Now, he's by far the most likely to be optimal pitcher. Whether or not you want to fade there is your decision. But let's take a look at a more extreme example, right? Kyle Isbell, 8-hole for the cheap, chalky Royals tonight. Optimal in 4.9% of sims, owned at 15.8%, right? Pretty clear leverage opportunity there from my point of view here, right? So this is kind of an analytical way that, and I don't like to do too much of this on intuition. That's kind of my flavor of DFS, is that I like to have, you know, a little bit more of at least a data-based approach for making some of these decisions. And this is one of the ways that I've kind of come up with doing that. There's nothing wrong with intuition, and there's nothing wrong with heuristics if they're applied correctly. So I said, you know, you said, I always hear to fade the high-owned SP2, but how do I know that one high-owned pitcher is the SP2 versus the other high-owned pitcher? So when people talk about that, this is, I think, a general trend that you'll see in baseball DFS. You get a lot of slates like this where there is, just because of the way salaries work and lineup constructions work, you often get a chalky ace, right? A guy that I would say is 9,500 DK salary or more, and then a chalkier value play guy, 8,500 salary or less, right? That's typically a lot of times how you see it break out. There will be an elite ace pitcher in the best overall matchup on the slate. That is the chalky stud guy. And the cheaper one is the SP2, right? So tonight it's Marco Gonzalez, right? We have very cheap very cheap hitter or a very cheap pitcher up against a terrible hitting team in a good friendly pitcher's park. And in on the other side, we have the best overall ace on the slate in a good matchup. Not so much of a good hitting park, but or a good, not so much of a good pitching park, but a good matchup. So Marco Gonzalez would be the chalky SP2. I think in general, you hear people say fade the chalky SP2 because a lot of times that guy isn't a very skilled pitcher himself, right? It's very, is probably in a good matchup, probably in a good pitching park, but oftentimes people are latching onto a minor price inefficiency, and it's a guy that maybe has significant downside risk or lacks upside himself. So you end up with this heuristic of always fade the chalk SP2. I don't do that. I don't use a lot of heuristics. Like tonight, I'm going to play the chalky Marco Gonzalez, at least at the moment of how this is looking, because I don't think he's actually going to be that overowned. I think he has a pretty high likelihood of being this the second most optimal pitcher on the slate. But I do think it is a decent heuristic, and I find that it is often right, even in my research build approach, that the chalky value pitcher is generally overowned. I found that's pretty consistent trend. I think that's actually a pretty decent heuristic. So there are a variety of different pathways to getting to this answer. There are a lot of different approaches. You can do something like this. Other tools out there, you know, I know there's a lot of other sites that do boom bust percentages, smash percentages, things like that. All of those are basically trying to calculate the same thing. What is the percent chance of this guy being in the winning lineup versus his ownership? I think there's also a big spectrum of more intuitive based players that, you know, just from experience, have a sense of where good opportunities to play versus fade chalk is, but you don't gain that experience without playing a lot of DFS in that sport. So I think you're probably better off starting from the standpoint of trying to be analytical about it by doing your own research builds or other research yourself, and going from there. So let me know if that helps. Hope that was clear, but you guys have me on my toes today here. These are good questions coming in. So HC says, how many teams is too many for stacking in a 20 max? It depends. You know, at some point you can only, I mean, you can only stack, you know, I guess really like two teams per lineup. So, I mean, realistically you could get exposure to almost every single team on the slate in a 10 game slate like we have here tonight. You could also be all in on two teams and stack two teams in every single lineup and play like every single combination of pitchers. Well, not every single combination, but a lot of different combinations of pitchers. The default sliders for a 20 max are going to probably put you somewhere kind of in between those two extremes. I think it's probably, I would say in a 20 max build, I typically would end up probably stacking five to eight different teams, probably having exposure to five to eight different team stacks there. A little bit of exposure to each of them, something like that. But I see no problem with condensing that exposure if you want to shoot for a bigger payout when you're right. And I see no problem with spreading out that exposure if you want to manage your risk a little bit. But like on tonight's slate, I was wrong here on tonight's slate. But you can see, I guess, we have like six different teams that we're getting most of our exposure to, and then we have like minor stacks for a ton of other different sleeves teams. So but yeah, I don't know. I don't think there's like a rule of thumb that I would say shoot for there. But good question. Wesley said, beginner to Saverson, but doing research builds and not winning. Any helpful tips? Honestly, Wesley, I've answered a lot of kind of similar questions, questions that are very similar to this earlier in the stream. I would watch those segments. I know I had a question about like just general MLB strategy. Just had a kind of a long question about research builds themselves. I would rewatch those. I would say that the best advice that I can give is that it's kind of summing up a whole bunch of different themes that we've talked about on the stream here today. It is a higher variance process of realizing your edge in baseball than it is in other sports, right? You can play in a way that is positive EV that would be profitable long-term over the course of a week, 2 weeks, even a month, and have pretty tough swings because the ranges of outcomes of players are so wide. It's easy to be very wrong when you're off. I think if you are watching some of the other streams and doing things like research build and, you know, correlating your lineups and leveraging against ownership and doing all of that good stuff, the best advice I can give, if it feels like you're losing a lot, is to spread out your exposures and manage your risk a little bit more and give yourself a little bit more equity to win back some of your winnings on a night-to-night basis or some of your buy-ins to smooth out those swings. And that's been something I've been doing a lot to start the season. I always play in, I don't want to say a risk-averse strategy, but I generally play most sports with a pretty spread out exposure to my player pool. That is the way I like to play. I like to play with a wide, diverse, and spread out player pool. And I've been diversifying even more to start the baseball season to weather some of the swings that I've been seeing as well. There are so many profitable routes to building a successful MLB DFS lineup, especially on a 10-game slate like we have here tonight, that I would much rather manage some risk and spread out. And I think that is the best advice I can give if you are already doing the other things, like making sure that your lineups are correlated and leveraged against ownership and things like that. So, but talked about this in a lot more detail at other parts of the stream today. As soon as we hop off here, which we are probably beginning to wrap up, I will work on putting the recording of this video up on YouTube and timestamping it. So if you want to go and specifically watch those other segments, it'll be clear in the timestamped description list what we talked about when. So, all right. Cool. I don't see any other questions coming in here. We are a little over an hour. It was a fun stream today. We talked about all kinds of different stuff. Thank you, everybody that came and hung out with me. Oh God, I'm fried here. can't even talk correctly. I appreciate it all. Appreciate you guys. I will be right back here again tomorrow. Same time, same place, 2 p.m. Eastern for another stream. If you are watching or listening to this and you have not yet signed up for SaberSim, we've got a free 7-day trial on our site, sabersim.com. You can come check us out for 7 days. No strings attached on that trial. Good luck on the 10-gamer tonight here. And I will be right back again tomorrow. See ya.